The headlines: a unanimous condemnation from the U.S. Security Council over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, and a call for an impartial investigation. Hamas urges the rapid formation of a unified Palestinian command to lead battlefields against Israel. And Russia planning to cut Finland's electricity supply as soon as Saturday, 2 days after the nation announces its bid to join NATO. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The United Nations Security Council has condemned the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. The 15-member body issued a unanimous condemnation on Friday. The Security Council called for an immediate, thorough, and transparent and impartial investigation into Abu Akleh's killing. She was a journalist at the Arabic language channel of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network. Abu Akleh, 51 years old, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin on Wednesday. She was wearing a press vest and standing with other journalists when targeted. The killing sparked an international outcry, with calls growing for Israel to be held accountable for the murder of the veteran reporter. Paul Larudi is a Free Palestine Movement activist. He says the UN Security Council's call for a probe is just face-saver for Israel, as its impartiality will be in question without a trusted panel.
The Security Council has asked for an impartial investigation. Well, but that they haven't said who's going to do this investigation, and it won't be impartial unless we have people from various opinions and who are trusted. And I can't imagine that the Security Council will provide a panel, an investigation panel that is actually impartial and will provide anything more than a slap on the wrist for Israel. They may say there, it appears that, or something. It'll be inconsequential. It's meaningless. It's a face saver for Israel and the United States. The rest of the world won't be able to trust it. Is someone from South Africa going to be there? Is someone from Venezuela going to be there? I don't think so.
Moving on, thousands of Palestinians have held a funeral for veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces. Abu Akleh was laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. Tensions simmered at the beginning of her funeral. Israeli forces attacked mourners trying to carry Abu Akleh's casket from a hospital to her funeral service in a church. The Palestinian Red Crescent says at least 33 people were injured in the Israeli attacks. She was killed by regime forces while reporting on a raid by troops in Jenin. Earlier, dozens of Palestinians were also injured after Israeli forces attacked the Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas denounced the raid, saying Jenin will continue its resistance against the occupying regime. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is calling for a quick formation of a single unified command to lead field battles with the Israeli regime. Head of the Political Bureau of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is calling on the Palestinian Authority to stop security cooperation with Israel. Haniyeh says the Palestinian Authority should focus on a comprehensive resistance plan to counter the regime. He says this needs a firm and strategic decision against Israel as Palestinians confront the regime on all levels. The senior Hamas official also says the Palestinian Authority should abolish the Oslo Accords, which it recognized as the which recognize the existence of Israel. His comments come on the eve of the anniversary of the formation of Israel on Palestinian lands, which Palestinians mark as Nakba, or the Day of Disaster. A Palestinian youth has succumbed to his wounds that he sustained during an Israeli attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque last month. Our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Mona Kentel, is joining us to tell us more about this latest development.
20-year-old Sharif, a Palestinian from the occupied city of Al-Quds, sustained to his injuries. On the third birthday of the Hajj of Ramadan. Sharif was taking part in a peaceful protest and trying to remain at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to prevent the Israeli forces and the Israeli Jewish settlers from raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We have to mention that in the holy month of Ramadan, we witnessed numerous incursions and by Israeli Jewish settlers and by the Israeli forces who were trying to force the Palestinian Muslim worshippers out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to allow the Israeli settlers to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in order to desecrate it. So Al-Sharif, since the third Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, he was in hospital, and this morning he succumbed to his serious injuries.
Mona, can you tell us more about any responses regarding to this tragic incident?
Well, let's say the martyrdom of Al-Sharif had brought to Palestinians these awful memories and painful days during the holy month of Ramadan. It's day after day. We can say that almost every day here in the occupied territories, Israeli forces are shooting and killing Palestinians in cold blood. So it wasn't Al-Sharif only who succumbed to his injuries. The day before, there was a Palestinian who was killed in the Jenin area. And there is also the killing in cold blood of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aqli. Israeli forces this morning have raided as well several Palestinian areas in the occupied West Bank. But even if every day there is a Palestinian being killed by the Israeli forces, Palestinians insist that nothing would end their insistence to continue the struggle and to continue resisting the occupation forces, especially that all Palestinian resistance groups and Palestinians from all walks of life today are united on one thing, that the Israeli occupation must come to an end, that they have a green light to be engaged in the different forms of resistance in order to fight the Israeli soldiers who are killing people and continuing with their aggression and oppression, knowing that they receive the impunity and that they will not be persecuted. Even if there is a call to take Israeli soldiers, criminals and killers to the International Criminal Court, however, this won't be easy, and this doesn't mean that Palestinians will have their right as easy as some people can believe.
Thank you very much, our correspondent, Mona Kandel from Ramallah. Moving on, people have gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy in Moscow to pay respect to the slain Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Aqli. She was killed by Israeli forces, as we told you, on Wednesday while covering the Israeli raid. Marina Kortanova has more.
The Embassy of Palestine in the Russian Federation organized a ceremony to pay tribute for veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Aqli, who was killed by Israeli forces in Jenin on Wednesday. Her colleagues, fellow journalists and people gathered near the embassy to condemn the Israeli regime for what they called the heinous crime.
Shireen's a person I knew well. She was murdered in cold blood. This is a great loss, not only for Al Jazeera, but for the entire journalistic community. Shireen was very professional, famous, and her name was associated primarily with Palestine. She's long been a symbol for the Palestinian people who are seeking freedom and justice.
Abu Akleh's killing follows a long string of Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists. According to the database of the Committee to Protect Journalists, 24 journalists have been killed in Israel and the Palestinian territories since 1992. While 14 people were caught in the crossfire, others appear to have been deliberate victims.
At least she made with me at least 5-6 interviews. Usually we saw her everywhere, the checkpoints, Jerusalem, in Gaza, in Jenin, in West Bank, everywhere. Where we need her, we find her, exactly. She's a very active journalist. And we are, as Palestinians, we never make a differentiation between Muslim and the Christian, never.
Journalists who were with Abu Akleh, including one who was shot and wounded, said Israeli forces fired upon them even though they were clearly identifiable as reporters.
The assassination of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh is another crime to be added to the criminal record of the Israeli regime, which for decades has been trying to silence the voice of truth and obliterate the Palestinian cause. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
Russia will cut power deliveries to Finland from Saturday. Now that is according to Finland's grid company, Fingrid. The company has cited lack of payments for the decision. Russia has not commented yet. The development comes 2 days after Finland announced its bid to join the Western military alliance, NATO. Finnish leaders said the country should apply for membership of, quote, without delay. Russia denounced the move, and the country said it will be forced to take retaliatory steps over its neighbor's move. Moscow is opposed to NATO's expansion towards its borders, considering it as a threat to its security. Now, that was the main motive for Russia to launch the Ukraine war after NATO failed to give Moscow security guarantees.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat. However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new study has found that young people across Europe have been the main victims of the economic and social crisis triggered by the COVID-19. Unemployment, job insecurity, and mental health problems are among the main consequences of the pandemic. Max Civelli reports.
Young people are those who most seriously bore the brunt for the COVID crisis in the European Union. A preliminary study carried out by European Cooperation Programme Specialised in Regional Analysis, or ESPON, has found youth unemployment across the EU went up by almost 22% with respect to pre-pandemic levels, with jobs going wasted in sectors affected the most by anti-COVID restrictions, such as hotels, restaurants and retail business.
Things have changed for the worse during the pandemic, definitely. I work as a kitchen hand and I've only been offered casual employment over the past months.
Dal Covid in poi le persone hanno iniziato ad aprire gli occhi.
The Covid health crisis has been an eye-opener for many young workers. Suddenly we found ourselves thrown into making a choice between badly paid, casual work and spending time at home doing nothing.
Food supply chain and tourism account together for about 35% of Italy's GDP. During the Covid crisis, hundreds of thousands of small and medium firms were forced to shut down, and a large number of young workers, the vast majority of whom under casual underpaid contracts, were left stranded. The Italian youth unemployment rate has traditionally stood at worrying levels. For almost two decades, youth joblessness in Italy has been more than the double of the total EU average, reaching a whooping 45% in 2015.
Noi oggi misuriamo 20 anni di scelte politiche.
Today, young people bear the brunt for 20 years of political choices which have included austerity policies, hence jobs cuts and funding cuts to education services, and labour policies which have deregulated the labour market, introducing tens of casual working contracts which have left the youth unprotected and unwilling to consider job opportunities in Italy.
The ESPON study has also found that over 60% of people aged 18 to 34 were at risk of depression in the EU in 2021, with the deterioration in mental health being particularly evident among those who had lost their occupation. Max Civili, Rome.
North Korea records more deaths from COVID as it battles its first ever outbreak since the pandemic began. Local media on Saturday reported 21 more deaths and about 174,400 new cases for one day earlier. North Korea's total COVID deaths are now 27. Its total cases are above 524,400. The country confirmed its first COVID cases in the capital, Pyongyang, on Thursday. The media said the patients had tested positive for Omicron, including one person who died. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says the outbreak has put the country in a great turmoil. Lockdowns are now in place nationwide to slow the spread of the disease. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Revelations by The Guardian show nearly 200 carbon bomb projects are in planning or have already started pumping that will each result in at least 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions over their lifetimes, equivalent to about 18 years of current global emissions. We are prepared for you a news report written jointly by Fiona Harvey, Matthew Taylor, and Damian Carrington. The piece is titled, IEA Chief Warns Climate Chaos Certain If Oil and Gas Mega Projects Go Ahead. The world's leading energy economist has warned against investing in large new oil and gas developments, which would have little impact on the current energy crisis and soaring fuel prices, but spell devastation to the planet. Fatih Birol, the executive director of the International Energy Agency, IEA, was responding to an investigation in The Guardian that revealed fossil fuel companies were planning huge carbon bomb projects that would drive climate catastrophe. He said countries must seek to replace Russian oil and gas in the near term without damaging their long-term prospects. He said, "I understand some countries may look at new fossil fuels, but they should remember it takes many years to start production," adding, "Such projects are not the solution to our urgent energy security needs, and they will lock in fossil fuel use." Revelations by The Guardian show nearly 200 carbon bomb projects are in planning or have already started pumping that will each result in at least 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions over their lifetimes, equivalent to about 18 years of current global emissions. Fatih Birol warned companies pursuing such developments could end up with uneconomic stranded assets. He said in an interview with The Guardian, "If the world is to succeed in moving to net zero emissions, these projects may fail to recover their upfront development costs." Soaring global energy prices has led governments to seek new sources of fossil fuels. He said, "I do understand why countries are reacting like this, but there is the issue of the time horizon." Fatih Birol warned big new exploratory projects for oil, gas and coal would take years to produce any fuel and could lock in high greenhouse gas emissions for decades. He added, "The most suitable projects are those with short lead times and quick payback periods, such as expanding production from existing fields." Birol noted, "Using existing sources more efficiently would also help reduce emissions." He said governments must also urgently seek to reduce fossil fuel demand through home insulation, cutting speed limits, making public transport cheap or free, and introducing car-free days in cities. He added, "If we do not have these voluntary measures, I'm afraid that energy rationing may be on the table." Fatih Birol said, unlike in previous oil shocks, such as those of the 1970s, the world now had cheap alternatives available in the form of solar and wind power, which had plummeted in price. This should prompt governments and companies to push harder for renewable energies. He said, "I believe we have the chance to make this a historic turning point to a cleaner and more secure energy system. This is the first time I have seen such momentum behind the change to clean energy." Fatih Birol noted, "The world does not need to choose between solving the energy crisis and climate crisis. We can do both." The United Nations Secretary General also called for an end to new fossil fuel projects, warning that climate change posed an existential threat to us all, to the whole world. Speaking at a press conference on Wednesday, 11th of May, Antonio Guterres, the United Nations Secretary General, said, "Main emitters must drastically cut their emissions starting now. This means accelerating the end of our fossil fuel addiction and speeding up the deployment of clean, renewable energy." International Energy Agency, the IEA, advised almost exactly a year ago that no new gas, oil or coal development could take place from this year onwards if the world was to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That finding caused shockwaves among governments in the run-up to the United Nations COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, last November, where leaders agreed to bring forward national plans in line with the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit. But many countries and private sector companies have ignored the advice, as The Guardian's investigation of fossil fuel projects under development has shown. These carbon bombs would in effect eliminate any hope of staying within the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold. Greg Muttit, an energy expert at the International Institute for Sustainable Development, said, "Governments and companies often suffer from a form of cognitive dissonance. While recognizing the urgency and severity of the climate threat, they still keep developing new oil, gas and coal fields and mines that will worsen the problem. The policy answer is a simple one. When in a hole, you need to stop digging." Greenpeace said The Guardian's investigation revealed the fossil fuel industry's business model remains a blueprint for climate catastrophe. The group's senior climate advisor, Charlie Kronick, said, "Investment plans by oil and gas firms will blow us past every assessment of what is safe for the climate, and that's shocking. But what's truly shocking is that they are not hiding it. These activities are legal and, in fact, are encouraged by governments around the world, particularly the ones that have the biggest reserves and the most to lose." Caroline Lucas, an MP for Britain's Green Party, said, in response to The Guardian's investigation, "Governments seem intent on sending us towards our own destruction. How many more times must we tell fossil fuel companies to keep it in the ground?" Ed Miliband, the Shadow Climate Change and Net Zero Secretary, said, "The answer to a global fossil fuel crisis cannot be a double down on fossil fuels. Every country must go further to rapidly accelerate the transition to clean energy." Ed Miliband added, "That's the right response to the climate crisis, but it's also the right response to the cost of living and energy security crises too. With renewable energies now by far the cheapest and most secure form of energy." Ed Miliband added, "Governments around the world should be urgently investing in a green energy sprint to shift decisively off destructive, expensive and volatile fossil fuels for good."
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Assassination of renowned journalist and reporter Shireen Abu Akleh was not a tragedy. Now another Israeli atrocity showing the regime's true colors has taken place. While tens of thousands of Palestinians were holding a funeral, Israeli regime forces attacked the mourners. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this tragic murder can possibly be transformed into an opportunity in order to pursue accountability and then move towards getting the rights of the Palestinians. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. International coordinator at Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us is author and researcher Daniel Yejic, who joins us from Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So another really sad day of importance here in terms of the brutality of the Israeli regime. No other way to put it, Charlotte Cates. I'm not too sure if you agree or not, but when you take a look how they have beaten the crowd of mourners when that procession was taking place, they were carrying the casket of the slain journalist, and from what we understand, and what the videos showed clearly, they start beating the mourners, and this happened in the front of that French hospital, and it actually almost made the people who were carrying the casket drop it. What did you think? What was your reaction when you saw that, if you did see it?
Absolutely. I mean, these images have now been seen by Palestinians everywhere and by people around the world, and really they are images that show the reality of what the occupation state, what the occupation project actually is, which is an entity, a project that is attempting to destroy Palestinian existence by all means, that even to the extent of assassinating a Palestinian journalist was not enough. There had to be an attempt to attack her coffin and drag it down, which of course failed. And that also says a lot about what the Zionist regime is doing in occupied Palestine. Thousands and upon thousands of Palestinians filled the streets of Jerusalem, carrying Palestinian flags, coming together to mourn Shireen Abu Akleh, who was truly a beloved voice of Palestine, someone who told the truth about the crimes of the Zionist regime to Palestinians, to Arabs, and to the world. And she was a beloved part of people's households, as well as a symbol of the fact that the Palestinian narrative and story and resistance has not been suppressed despite 74 years of ongoing Nakba. And so when the occupying regime looks at the streets of Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine, filled with Palestinians mourning their beloved Shireen, mourning their martyrs, and coming together, what they see is the same thing that can give the people of the world hope, is the same thing that strikes fear in the heart of the occupier, and that is the promise of a liberated Palestine tomorrow, that Shireen's death will not kill her voice, and that she and everything that she stood for, and that all of the martyrs of Palestine stood for, will live on despite these horrendous scenes of brutality and destruction.
To expand a little bit more on this, Daniel Yadish, we understand that Abu Akleh's brother was actually summoned by the Israeli authorities and told to basically instruct the mourners not to carry Palestinian flags and recite Palestinian chants. But what's the explanation for that? Of course, I'm sure that they didn't tell Abu Akleh's brother that they were going to beat up on the mourners that were carrying the casket.
Yeah, I mean, this is just another attempt by the Zionist regime to silence not only Palestinians, but any form of or any visibility of Palestinian nationality and Palestinian unity. So we have seen in these videos you've referred to, there were many that came out from Jerusalem today, how scared the Israelis actually are, how afraid they are when they see Palestinian flags, when they see masses of Palestinians, Muslims, and Christians mourning together a beloved person that meant so much, not only for Palestinians, but for people in the entire Arab region and beyond. And the Palestinian flag as a symbol of unity and also as a symbol of the national identity and the resistance and, in fact, the mere survival of Palestinians after decades of Zionist genocidal settler colonialism and terrorism, of course, terrifies the Zionist regime because eventually, I mean, to put, you know, the long story short, the Israeli regime bases itself on the genocidal expulsion and dispossession of Palestinians. Of course, I can also imagine that the Israeli regime was obviously aware that a lot of people would gather and would mourn the martyr. So they were, of course, afraid of those Palestinian flags and this show of unity, because this is something that they were not able to destroy. And they've been trying to do that for a century now. And it just, again, I think shows the survival of the indigenous people and the mere fact that they are on their indigenous land. And this continues to be a major obstacle to the Zionist regime, and in fact, maybe also a major chance eventually towards the liberation of Palestine.
This point needs to be highlighted and really expanded more in terms of it being spread. I'm guessing that it's important in that respect, Charlotte Cates, and that is the fact that you had the reversal by Israel saying that perhaps there needs to be an investigation done. Perhaps the soldier that did this needs to be investigated, that maybe they're accepting the possibility that maybe one of their soldiers did it, which goes against what the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said. And, of course, they did attempt by circulating that video that reportedly showed that maybe it was Palestinian fire, but then they I don't know how they could have been confused as to the location, which turned out not to be the right location, which was a PR spin that failed miserably. Is this going to have any buyers when people know that Israel, based on what happened, is and the security forces or a particular soldier is guilty of this?
Well, what we see time and time again is that the Zionist regime attempts to shift responsibility for its assassinations, its murders, its massacres. It attempts to create confusion around the issue. It attempts to blame the occupied people themselves or cast the blame on the resistance in one way or another, whether it is to say that, it was fine for us to bomb this apartment building full of families because we say that someone who is in the resistance lives there, or whether they will try to claim that it was a stray bullet of the resistance that killed Shireen Abu Akla, even though you had the eyewitness testimony of all of the journalists who were surrounding her at the same time and place, speaking very clearly about the situation that they saw and witnessed, and in the case of her colleague Ali Samoudi, were shot in the back by in the same situation. It's been very clear from the research by human rights investigators, by organizations, that the Israeli narrative was completely fraudulent and forged. At the same time, while we are seeing growing demands for accountability that is actually putting pressure on the Zionist regime, what we see over and over again is that all of the so-called investigations and inquests into the ongoing and systemic war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by Zionist soldiers against Palestinians is that all of these are essentially a whitewash. They're essentially a form of simply granting impunity for the death of a Palestinian, whether she is a journalist covering their crimes in action as they are taking place, or whether she is a girl going home in a taxi or a father driving in his car, there is constant impunity. And so that's why there can never be any reliance on the so-called justice system of the Zionist project itself, which exists only to maintain that project in occupied Palestine. This does have to be an occasion where people who care about justice and accountability around the world, particularly in Western countries, the imperialist powers that are backing the Zionist project, put real pressure on our government to stop engaging in this ongoing justification of this criminal regime and instead engage in a real boycott of the occupation and a real rejection of this illegitimate settler colonial project occupying Palestine. And to say that we cannot accept anymore that the US, Canada, the European Union continue to make only mild statements of concern while allowing this impunity to proceed unchecked.
Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit further down the road here. But one of the things that perhaps should have been taken seriously, Daniel Yejish, and maybe it wasn't, maybe there was just an oversight somehow, were the words coming out from Naftali Bennett's mouth after we saw that incident happen in Tel Aviv, which was a resistance operation where the Palestinian came and there were a few casualties, of which he came out and said point blank, full freedom to act to the Israeli security forces. There are not and will not be limits for this war. we're granting full freedom of action to the army, the Shin Bet, etc. That should have been taken. That should have. I'm guessing that really should have been given some weight to it, because here we are, and this is what has happened. But then, when you put things into context, there are Palestinians that are being killed every day. I mean, the day that the reporter was assassinated, you had another Palestinian. I think a 16 or 17-year-old Palestinian that was killed. So what lessons can be learned from this, and how can we build on this momentum going forward, Daniel Yedish, in order to make sure that somehow Palestinians are getting their rights back and having the regime change its behavior at best case scenario?
Yeah. I don't think that the regime will change its behavior. I think the only way forward is to dismantle the apartheid regime and the Zionist entity. This is the only way for freedom, for liberation, for human rights, for the implementation of equality and justice. There cannot be any form of justice nor equality as long as this apartheid regime is in place that really bases itself on the blood of the Palestinian people. And when it comes to those statements made by the Israeli Prime Minister of Tali Bennett, who is, of course, like all other politicians within the Zionist entity, part of this genocidal regime. And I just would like also to remind that Naftali Bennett is a mass murderer who has invaded Lebanon on several occasions and has bragged about how many Arabs he's killed in his life. So it is not surprising to hear such statements from someone who's based his entire political career on racism and white supremacy and genocidal fantasies. And eventually, as you mentioned, the killing of Palestinians, of innocent Palestinian people on a daily basis, is part and parcel of the Zionist project and of daily reality in Palestine, as Palestinians continue to face this genocidal erasure at the hands of this nuclear-armed First World apartheid regime. So even then, again, within this context, I think it is impossible to think about investigations and accountability, because any form of implementing UN resolutions, implementing international law, implementing the fundamental human rights would effectively dismantle the apartheid regime, which is based on one particular group of the population dominating, having access to rights, as opposed to the majority population, Palestinians, who do not have access to rights, nor citizenship, nor anything else, and are being fragmented and separated within their own land. And again, I mean, just today, during the funeral procession where a journalist who was murdered was attacked even after her death, at the same time, there were settlers taking over Palestinian homes as this was happening. So this is a multidimensional, multifaceted form of state terrorism that the Zionist entity is inflicting on Palestinians. And within these structures, no justice, accountability, or any prospect for change for the better is possible at all.
Let's look at what the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has said, Charlotte Cates, and I'm using him as an example, where he came out and obviously was very disturbed by what had happened and said that he's going to take her case to the International Criminal Court in what he said, an effort to get justice for the veteran reporter, as he said. Well, when you hear this and you hear about International Criminal Court, or you hear about the UN and you hear about the international community, you know, these things that have become redundant, because have they really served the rights that Palestinians deserve, or have they done anything? I mean, what are they going to do? What's your take when you hear, for example, again, I'm using him as an example, that this should be taken to the International Criminal Court? I mean, there's got to be other ways. These things have become just tired, in a sense.
Well, it is important to say that when we're talking about specifically Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority could do much more by ending security coordination and its ongoing participation with the Israelis in the attacks and assassination of the Palestinian resistance than it can by making statements about Shireen Abu Akleh. Now, of course, Shireen is a beloved symbol of all Palestinians, but the Palestinian Authority's continued participation in the Oslo process is continuing to attack and undermine the Palestinian resistance. And so we do have to question the sincerity of these kinds of pronouncements. Now, the International Criminal Court is something that we do see the Israeli occupation taking seriously. This is one reason why they threw a terrorist label on six human rights organizations, many of which are directly involved in the attempts to prosecute the Zionist project in the International Criminal Court. Of course, at the same time, we do see that these institutions are, like all of these international institutions, unfortunately, it is still the imperialist powers that are holding the balance of power there. And so we see a declaration that the ICC is going to expedite an investigation into Ukraine while Palestine continues to wait for over 74 years. So these kinds of initiatives to hold the occupation accountable in the International Criminal Court, in international courts, through the legal system is important. It's an important form of work and advocacy. But fundamentally, it is the resistance that holds the hope for the liberation of Palestine. And so it is in the aims of supporting the struggle of the resistance that all of this work, that legal work, advocacy, organizing, has to continue in order to engage in a multifaceted struggle to support the liberation of Palestine. But this does not mean that these institutions are sufficient to meet that end. Clearly, they are not. It is necessary to confront imperialism and confront Zionism at a fundamental level, and these and the legal work is part of that struggle, but it can never replace or supplement for the resistance of the Palestinian people and the regional and international resistance. Instead, this legal work is part of the project of working on accountability on all fronts, because just as we see the occupier attempting to besiege Palestinians and even those in solidarity with Palestine on all fronts, we must turn that dynamic of siege around and besiege the occupier everywhere. And that includes in the courts, and that is in service of the project of resistance and liberation and not a substitute for it.
Well, indeed, as I said, we need to build, or we, everyone really, whoever cares for the issue of Palestine, needs to build on this momentum. Now, there were a couple scenes that stood out recently. One was today, obviously, when we saw, and yesterday, Daniel Yedish, when we saw tens of thousands of mourners that came out, and there were so many people that came out, and that was quite incredible. And also during Ramadan, one of the prayers, one of the nights, or a couple of the nights, there were estimated 100 to 150,000 Palestinians or people who came out and prayed. When you have the massive numbers like that, that energy is there, whether it's in the form of the resistance that Charlotte Cates talks about, or people who are obviously Palestinians who need to be recognized for their rights. But there needs to be something that takes the lead in order for all this energy to be channeled, in order for this to highlight what's happening. Why is that not happening on a massive scale? Do you think it's because of a lack of leadership, perhaps? Which some have said, you know, Palestinians don't really have one to look to. Of course, we can't include Hamas nor the resistance groups out of the Gaza Strip on that, because they have come out and condemned Israeli atrocities whenever they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the Israeli regime and its allies have for decades invested a lot to segregate and fragment Palestine and Palestinians from one another. And I think this is one of the major obstacles, is geographic fragmentation. If we look into at a map of Palestine, not only are Palestinians legally divided into different categories, into those in the 48 territories and Gaza in East Jerusalem in the West Bank, but also within the West Bank there are those enclaves, settlements, illegal Israeli settlements, and so on, that really affect Palestinians' everyday mobility, that render Palestine into different forms of open-air prisons. And the Zionist regime has, over those decades, re-engineered new forms of population control and containment to make sure Palestinians remain fragmented. And again, despite all of this, we've seen, as you mentioned today, thousands, about hundreds of thousands of people still gathering in the same place. So the energy is there. But in the end, I also think that If we look at it from a global perspective, there is support for Palestine all around the world. It is eventually the what we refer to as international community, which includes Western Europe, North America, and settler colonies around the world, represent a tiny percentage of the world's population. And even in those places, there are many people who do support Palestine and whose governments are not necessarily representative of the populations perspectives when it comes to Palestine. So in the end, this is really, if we look at it, a very fragile system of the Zionist entity that is imposed on Palestine, and that does have the advance of those weapons and of this very flawed international law system. And this has been kept in place in a very, very violent way against Palestinians. And then, of course, also the fragmentation within the region. There is a great support for Palestine among the people. There are other resistance groups that do support Palestine. But again, the imperialist, colonialist, and Zionist structures transnationally have made it very difficult. But I still think that the fact that what we see today is just another proof of that Palestinians, even if their eyewitness accounts and their decades of experience with Zionist violence are being ignored by Western regimes in the media and mainstream media and in politics, they're still there. They're still fighting for their liberation, and I'm very certain that this will eventually take place.
A final question goes to Charlotte Cates. If we were to take a look at any type of leadership that I just mentioned, I think there needs to be a push on the officials, higher up officials, or leaders of certain Arab countries, or all of them, if the issue of Palestine is relevant, which it is, and that issue needs to be partaken by them in order for it to be spread quickly and maybe something can come out of it. Of course, that's now in competition with some of them who are running to formalize the relationship with Israel. So it's in contradiction to that. How much of a chance do you see there?
I mean, the Arab people have made clear time and time again that Palestine is still the compass of the direction for justice and liberation for the region. And Shireen Abu Akleh was not only known and beloved in Palestine, but everywhere where her voice was heard, and especially in Arab homes. Unfortunately, it is the regimes that are engaging in normalization projects with Zionism right. are the same ones that are fully dependent on the imperialist powers for their continuing existence as as the rulers over these people. So it's a matter of challenging imperialism and supporting the Arab people to victory over normalization. And there is still a great amount of hope for Arab struggle for Palestinian liberation, and that will never be destroyed despite leaderships and regimes that are serving imperialism.
Thank you, Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadin, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. Daniel Yedges, thank you, author and researcher from Beirut. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's great tip: what are the secrets of having a heart at peace, and how this relates to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah.
Allah, 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 Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
Now, dear listeners, we are talking about ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, and what needs to be done in order to enhance, increase, strengthen, and overall improve and perfect our ubudiyah, our servitude, obedience, and worship to Allah. Now, one of the very interesting and probably most profound things that are taught to us by the esteemed noble ulama and urafa, ulama being the religious scholars and the urafa being the spiritual masters, per se. And of course, these two cannot be separated from each other, for the ulama must be the urafa, and the urafa must be the ulama. The religious scholars need to be the spiritual masters, and the spiritual masters need to be the religious scholars. For a spiritual master with no religious schooling or no religious backing or no religious knowledge is not truly a spiritual master, and vice versa, a religious scholar who has no spirituality or is not a spiritual master or on the road to either one of these, it does not complete the equation. But anyways, we were talking about how these religious scholars and these spiritual masters, they speak about the heart, and how the heart is one of the central aspects of ubudiyah. Now, of course, a heart which is not at peace, which is what we are talking about, a heart that is not at peace won't allow us to achieve and gain the results of a proper ubudiyah. The heart of an individual must be at peace, it must be cleansed, it must be purified, if one is to receive the divine light, the nur of wisdom and knowledge and piety and taqwa and all these other kinds of aspects of divine light. If one is to acquire this, then the heart must be at peace, it must be pure, it must be clean. And so we have a very great role in making sure that our heart, this beautiful aspect of our existence, is to remain at peace, clean, and pure so that we can receive the divine light of Allah the Exalted.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Your up
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you